From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Governor Roy Cooper's statewide face mask mandate presents legal questions and practical enforcement concerns. We'll discuss both with a constitutional law expert. Some state lawmakers continue to pursue criminal law reform. They want to clean up a messy state criminal code. You'll learn about their latest attempt. The COVID-19 pandemic has had a major negative impact on the state and national economies. We'll learn about keys to addressing the recovery. And we'll discuss supply and demand shocks in North Carolina healthcare linked to the pandemic. Why are some hospitals struggling? Those topics are just ahead, but first, Donna Martinez joins us, and she has the Carolina Journal headline.
Try to decipher the budget of the North Carolina Department of Transportation, and you will likely have a tough time figuring out what's going on and why, where the money's coming from, and where it's going. Our next guest is an expert at analyzing agency budgets. And in the wake of a scathing audit of the Department of Transportation by the state auditor, Beth Wood, our Joe Coletti is helping us understand exactly what's going on with the DOT's budget. Joe is senior fellow here at the John Locke Foundation. He's been writing about this at johnlocke.org. Joe, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be here.
Set the table for us, if you would. Tell us about this audit of DOT from state auditor Beth Wood. It was pretty tough.
This is the latest in a number of challenges and reports taking a look at DOT that have not been kind to the department. And the auditor found that the Department of Transportation had overspent by $742 million of what it was And you can't say that it was over budget, because one of the findings was that they really kind of don't have a budget. So they had a cash flow plan.
Not good on two fronts.
Right, yeah. So they had a cash flow plan, and when they looked at that cash flow plan versus what was actually spent, that was the $742 million, which actually matched up really well with what McKinsey had reported back in September, when there were the first concerns about what's going on at DOT. And all of this stems back to concerns about how much cash DOT had accumulated over time. The legislature wanted them to spend that down, wanted them to be faster with projects, getting those out, and offered some opportunity to borrow money to be able to speed that up if they had a lower cash flow. And then they put a cash floor under that. And all of this just kept compounding itself into more problems, so that the DOT trying to get the money, to qualify for the bonds by having a lower amount in cash, overspent all of that cash, $742 million, according to the auditor, And that was to be able to get more projects out. So
you're making my hair hurt here.
There's no good plans coming in, and they spent a lot of money going out, and that was so that they could spend even more money. That's really
so. Yeah. Joe, here's the curious thing. I mean, I'm not a fiscal expert like you are, but I just know that I presume that the state legislature, which appropriates money to state government and different agencies, that they would say, okay, Department of Transportation, here is the amount of money that you will receive for the next fiscal year. Right. Operate your agency, repair the roads, do your projects, et cetera. But what you're describing is so far from that. Right. Why is DOT so different? Why does it not operate like that?
Yeah, there's few reasons for that. One is that most of DOT's budget does not come from the general fund. So all of the state money that the Department of Transportation gets is not general fund, which is where the legislature usually steps in and is involved on a line-by-line basis.
Right.
The DOT gets money from the Highway Fund and the Highway Trust Fund, which are funded by gas taxes, sales taxes on cars, registrations, all of the licensing that you do to be able to drive on the roads. All of that money then goes into the Department of Transportation, and then you pull down another chunk of money from the federal government. But they have kind of large pools of money that goes into. But the money actually gets spent by the divisions, and there are seven divisions across the state. And so there's a general plan that says we're going to spend money on highways, and we're going to spend money on secondary roads, and we're going to do this, and we're going to do this. But then the money goes to the agencies, to those divisions as a mass, and then those divisions spend that money on individual projects. And so when you take a look at the state budget, you end up with double counting of all of these things. And so there's not really the same kind of oversight from the General Assembly in the first place. And then the department operates in a different way, and they're doing road projects because they're multiple year projects. They don't account for them in the same way that most of the operating budget gets accounted for.
Even though it's obviously complicated, mm-hmm. and unlike most state agencies, doesn't the Department of Transportation have internal auditors or internal project managers whose job one would presume is to watch over the money, what's going out, what's coming in, and presumably also saying, hey, wait a second, you know, we're working on a project and we're running out of cash?
Yeah, that's one of the problems that was found, was that there's not a really
pretty
good
fundamental.
Yeah. They don't have those solid internal controls either. There's the lack of external control from the General Assembly, but there's also lacking internal controls. And that was clear in the auditor's recommendations too, because the auditor focused all of the attention on the chief engineer instead of on the chief financial officer. The engineer, right, you can tell by the title, is working on how do we get projects through.
Right.
And
this bridge, this road needs to stand the test of time.
And the chief financial officer, chief fiscal officer, should be the one who's saying, okay, here's how much money we have, how we're doing on plan. And they're just all of those controls that you would think are there weren't. And it's been a longstanding problem. The rush to spend the money during 2019 is what led to blew away what little guardrails they had.
So, Joe, you have described it really well. In fact, I love the headline on your piece, which, folks, by the way, you can read this at johnlock.org. It's a really good explanation of this mess, the budget being full of cracks, potholes, and detours. So what do we do now? Because clearly, as taxpayers, and I'm sure there's people within the DOT agency mm-hmm. itself who were kind of embarrassed about this.
Right.
What do we do to go forward and rein all this in, make sure mm-hmm. they do their job and they have them, they know how much money they have and they know when to stop spending?
Yeah. So, there have been recommendations, and that's one of the things that's, is being sorted out now. One of the recommendations was that the Office of State Budget and Management have a more active role in overseeing the Department of Transportation. The OSBM said thank you, but no. but they are working on how do you provide the money in a more reasonable way, in a more standard way, putting actual budgets in place at the Department of Transportation, and then aligning those budgets in an appropriate way. So it's and ideally, then you also implement the rest of those internal controls so that you can say, here's what budget is. And to the question that you asked earlier, here's what your budget is. Here's what your spending plan is. How are you doing on both of those?
Joe, in our remaining moments here, what do we do going forward when we're facing this situation with a lot of the DOT's money, or at least some of it, based on the gas tax? And we know that our vehicles are getting more fuel efficient, so we're buying fewer gallons of gas. So that gas tax really isn't going to cover things like it used to. What do we do?
They're looking at vehicle mileage tax, and there's a pilot that's starting soon to take a look at that for people to be able to opt in. And part of it is that we just need to take a look at what are the roads that we need and how do we spend the money in the first place before we worry about how we finance it.
Joe Coletti, who is senior fellow here at the John Locke Foundation. Go to johnlocke.org and read Joe Coletti's piece headlined, "The NCDOT Budget is Full of Cracks, Potholes, and Detours." Joe, thanks very much.
Thank you, Donna.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly. But our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Governor Roy Cooper has ordered everyone in North Carolina to wear a face mask. Enforcement of that order creates both practical problems and legal concerns. That's the conclusion our next guest has reached. Jeanette Doran is president and general counsel of the North Carolina Institute for Constitutional Law. Welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So this is pretty a widespread order from Governor Cooper. Everyone, with some exceptions, has to wear a face mask. Given your role as a constitutional lawyer, you looked at this and found problems of more than one type. Let's, first of all, before we get to the practical problems, you're not even talking about whether the governor has the authority to order people to wear face masks and whether face masks themselves are worthy of wearing. You sort of set that to the side.
We assumed for the sake of discussion that face masks are useful. I think a lot of people figure that these days, that there's been some debate about that and government guidance has evolved. But we also assumed, just for the sake of argument, that the governor has the authority to issue a statewide mandate that everyone, with a few exceptions, has to wear a face mask. So we assumed that and focused really on the enforcement protocols in his executive order.
Given those assumptions, which people could argue with, but given those assumptions, let's start first with practical problems. What do you see as practical problems with this order?
There are quite a few, actually. So there have been a number of reports across the country of violence toward really frontline workers when they've asked customers and patrons to wear a mask or comply with social distancing requirements. So what the governor's done is he has, by forcing businesses to be the ones to enforce this face mask mandate, what he's done is he's required businesses to take on what is essentially a law enforcement role. And that is a problem because those are not workers who are trained in the sorts of de-escalation tactics that are part of basic law enforcement training. So what's going to happen if we have, you know, a 16-year-old hostess at a restaurant ask a patron to put on his mask and he loses it? I mean, tensions are high. People are so incredibly stressed emotionally, financially. So this is the sort of lightning rod that could create a huge physical altercation under these sorts of circumstances. And of course, violence is never the answer, but it happens. And the governor should anticipate that. This is totally foreseeable. Then if you're a business owner, you've got to ask yourself, you know, what's my liability? Am I going to get sued by an employee who gets assaulted? Am I going to get sued by a customer who perhaps is grieved by an overzealous employee? And then, of course, there are lots of privacy and discrimination laws that come into issue. And I think the governor, to his credit, tried to work around some of those legal issues.
You alluded to this, but we should point out that the reason that these are the practical concerns is that although this is an order for everyone to wear a face mask, the order is not contingent on law enforcement stopping an individual and charging them. The businesses are the ones and other organizations are the ones who are mandated to carry this out.
Yes. So if you read through the order states businesses must require that their customers or, in the case of restaurants, patrons, wear a face mask. When one scrolls down to, it's about page 8 of the executive order.
Which is bad news in and of itself. It's at least 8 pages.
Yes, yes, indeed. When you get down to the enforcement section, the governor specifically states in number 1, and there are 3 there, in number 1, he specifically states, only businesses and organizations will be cited. Number 2, he specifically states law enforcement is not authorized to issue citations to individual workers, customers, or patrons for failing to wear a mask. Now, at number 3, he states that law enforcement can cite people for trespassing if a business asks a customer to leave and they refuse to do so. But that's just a reflection of the current state of law on trespass. So he's put all of the responsibility for enforcing the mask requirement on businesses.
We've talked about the practical concerns. Let's turn now to some of the legal issues. As a person who focuses on constitutional law, you looked into, okay, if the governor is going to give this order, what is the basis? How can he go about doing this? We know that governors can't do anything they want to do. What did you find when you looked into the basis of the authority the governor has to issue this order?
Well, it's interesting the way the order is structured. He cites at various points in the beginning, actually for several pages at the beginning of his executive order, miscellaneous statutes. Most specifically, he seems to cite the Emergency Management Act, the particular statute that gives him, quote, additional powers during a declared state of emergency. Unfortunately, when we get down to the portion of the executive order with the specific mandates, things like capacity limitations and face mask requirements, there is not what a lawyer would refer to as a pinpoint or specific site adjacent to the directive. So we don't know for each of those orders exactly which of the statutes the governor is relying on for his statutory authority.
And from a layman's perspective, why should they care?
Well, the governor doesn't have the authority to just make up the law as he goes. And that surprises people because if you read these executive orders, they smell and read and look very much like legislation. But constitutionally, the governor doesn't get to legislate. Now, he does have authority to issue executive orders. And during a state of emergency, we have statutes that give him extra authority. But we're not clear which of those statutes he's relying on, which makes it difficult to figure out whether he is exceeding the scope of what's called statutory authority.
And there are some instances in which things that the governor might want to do, he can't do on his own. He needs to get input from the other elected statewide officials.
Correct.
Who we know as the Council of State.
Correct. There is a portion of the additional powers statute. It's there are basically 4 parts, A, B, C, and D. So part B, which really gives him a great deal of authority, but it only gives him a great deal of authority if he seeks concurrence of the Council of State.
Now, this obviously is of concern to a constitutional lawyer. Why should this be of concern to the average voter or average resident of North Carolina?
I think we all, as voters, as citizens, as people committed to our community and to our state, we need to hold government accountable. We need to put their feet to the fire and ask them to show us what authority they have, because if we don't do it now, we're going to end up potentially in a dictatorial state I don't think anybody wants to live under a dictatorship.
Well, it'll be very interesting. And we know that one person who's going to be watching very closely as this issue progresses is Jeanette Doran. She is president and general counsel of the North Carolina Institute for Constitutional Law. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know, same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina lawmakers continue work to clean up the state's criminal code. Republican State Senator Andy Wells recently presented the latest plan.
Senate Bill 855 is the next step in what's been a years-long process of dealing with inconsistencies and lack of transparency in the criminal code across state government and local governments.
Wells reminded his colleagues that they had tried to turn the task over to a group called the General Statutes Commission.
That has not gone well either. They did receive information from some of the counties and some of the cities and some of the agencies, but it was in a form that made it impossible for them to access it, sort it, and get it in a form that they could deal with it. They noted the poor quality of many of the reports. It hindered the commission's ability to accumulate the information needed to make this determination, and the commission recommends that the General Assembly establish a criminal code recodification commission.
That's the purpose of a proposed new group.
It is a bipartisan commission with the input and participation from stakeholders outside of the General Assembly. The working group is current members of the General Assembly, House, Senate, Republican, Democrat. We have worked with the UNC Criminal Justice Innovation Lab. Effectively, we would be going through a process where UNC School of Government hires attorneys that are expert in criminal code and works through a process to sort out and catalog over a year's period criminal code at the state agency level, at the licensing board level, at the county and city level, and get all those sorted out in a way that we can all see, that us non-lawyers can look at them and see the redundancies that we've got. You know, we're defining something like theft in multiple ways with multiple penalties depending on what you steal, and there are just inconsistencies, and it's impossible for a layman to know what crime they are committing in the state of North Carolina. They can't go to any one place. They need to go to about 600 places to find out what crimes they may be committing and know what they're doing ahead of time. And that's what we're trying to do, is get this in one place, organized, and that's the process of this. That's the reason for this bill.
Big decisions about the criminal code will remain with state lawmakers.
The commission can't do anything about it. They can present to a General Assembly the ability to, that here's some things that we think need to be changed, and that General Assembly has the ability to make those changes, but at least they'll be in a form, a coherent form, that they can address the process.
That's State Senator Andy Wells. He's discussing the latest proposals for cleaning up North Carolina's complicated criminal code. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. It's no secret that the COVID-19 pandemic has throttled the American economy. What can government do? What should it do to help get the economy moving again? Jonathan Williams recently addressed that topic in an online interview with the John Locke Foundation. Williams is chief economist and vice president at the American Legislative Exchange Council. He first discussed the federal government's role.
Obviously, there was going to be something that was going to be done at a federal level to address something of this magnitude of a health and economic crisis. I think one of the things that I often have thought through in recent weeks is kind of harkening back to a story Art Laffer told me, that Ronald Reagan, when he was going through one of the challenges of the 1980s, he, of course, was very aware that the inclination of government is to always do something new and in some cases pass needed laws and regulation. Sometimes they're over the top, depending on how it's structured, of course. But Reagan's line to his staffer has always stuck with me, which is, don't just stand there, go undo something. And I think that's really one of the important points from a free market principle perspective is, yes, there's going to be lots of things that are going to pass. There are going to be massive packages at the federal and state and local levels. There's going to be lots of things in there that are probably good and some things in there that are probably not good, perhaps lots of things. But at the end of the day, let's look at what are the things that we can do to remove barriers for individuals, for businesses, for the economy to get back working again and to return some normalcy and livelihood back to hardworking Americans out there across the United States, and not just always take for granted that it's government's role to do something new, but what is it that's on the books that we can take away and enhance liberty, enhance free markets? What are the things that government can undo to unleash entrepreneurs and innovators in the private sector to be able to get us some real answers and solutions to this real challenge that we all face.
At the state government level, Williams says North Carolina is in a better position than many of its peers.
North Carolina has done a lot of wise decision making in recent years, and it really does point to prudent decision making that's going to help tide you over. And hopefully we can have a pathway to get the economy opened before some of these funds start to run dry and you buy yourself enough time where you don't have to raise employer taxes, let's say, on unemployment or people go without when they're really in need. And I think, you know, it sets up a really interesting contrast for the other model of states, the states that during record revenue times over the last 5 or 6 years due to the strong enduring economic recovery, you have states now that are coming and lobbying their members of Congress as we speak to have a bailout of the states. Because after a few weeks of going without a normal process, these states are now finding themselves in dire situation, which is exactly, you know, what a lot of us from a fiscally responsible perspective have been warning against, that you do not overspend during the good times, because whether it's a black swan type of an event like we saw happen, which really nobody could foresee coming, or the normal correction that was probably going to come anyways with the regular business cycle, this was going to happen. And I think it just kind of exposes the vulnerabilities of states that were profligate during very good times. And it highlights, I think, the benefit of prudent policymaking like you've seen in North Carolina for all to see.
That's Jonathan Williams, chief economist at the American Legislative Exchange Council. He participated in a recent online forum with the John Locke Foundation. Williams looked ahead to the world after the COVID-19 pandemic.
We need to be looking at a pathway, whether it's federal or state or local. We at least need to have some plans in place, and they need to be really put out there for the public to comment on and for private sector leaders to comment on. And I'm really heartened to see comments that the president would include private sector entrepreneurs as well as members of the medical community and economists in this commission. And I think that's really important because at the end of the day, it's not going to be a government bureaucrat that turns the light switch back on and says everything's okay. It's going to be innovators and entrepreneurs that are going to come back in and say, we're safe to operate within legal bounds. How do we enhance consumer confidence to get people back into our businesses? They're already seeing, I'm seeing even in the Washington Post this weekend, different supermarket chains having ads saying, here are all the safety measures we're coming up with, not because government told us we needed to, but because we want to make you feel safe about coming into our store and shopping again. And if we don't get the American public to a place where they feel safe to come in and go to a restaurant, go to a supermarket, get on an airplane again eventually, you know, this is going to be a very long road ahead. And so I think involving the private sector early on for people who know how to reopen safely in a way that gives consumers the confidence to come back is really important. And one point moreover that I really think is important that's gotten lost in the headlines of certainly the national mainstream media is the president deserves a whole lot of credit for not nationalizing stay-at-home orders. You know, there's always this withering pressure in order for the federal government to take lead, and especially times of crisis. And he's resisted that, I think, very wisely. And whether we disagree or agree with the actions that individual governors or mayors or county executives have taken, at least we've preserved the principle of federalism to allow these decisions to happen at the state and local level. That's so important as we kind of re-tier an opening of the economy. It's got to happen in the lower risk areas and in spots around the country that haven't been affected, not a one-size-fits-all solution. And that's exactly what the founders were getting at when they came up with these ideas of 50 laboratories of democracy.
What about the impact of all the new government spending on the federal debt?
Boy, isn't that the big question? And I would say it's a $1 trillion question, but that would be far underselling how big of an issue this is. In fact, I see some reports, the national debt clock I looked at, happened to look at it last night, and we're at the $24 trillion range when it just seemed like we just hit $23 trillion in national debt, and now we've just added a couple trillion to it based on the recent packages coming out of Capitol Hill. And it's absolutely right. I think once we get through this election season, when everybody's just kind of focused on re-election and spending more, rightly so in many cases, on some of the health issues and how to respond to this really once in a generation, once in a lifetime threat that we face to the economy and to public health systems. But that being said, how do we reevaluate, pick up the pieces when this is behind us and have a real plan in place, not just to reopen the economy, which is the first piece of this, but then once we have the economy going, how do we address this massive burden that we've accumulated on top of what was a big burden? You know, we talk about the states that acted irresponsibly during some very good market conditions over the last 5 or 6 years, especially, but the federal debt has continued to enhance regardless of who's in power in Washington, D.C. It's on more or less autopilot, unfortunately, based on the way that budget rules are crafted in Washington. And I think, you know, the president in his budget this year, just before all of this hit with the pandemic, really outlined some good steps to start to reduce the budget in terms of the debt, and also look at things like fiscal rules that have been so important in the state level, things like Colorado's taxpayer bill of rights, to limit the growth of government to something reasonable, such as a private sector limit, a population and inflation. Clearly, the federal government does not even attempt to balance a budget in many cases where it's a requirement at the state level. We've added mountains of new debt. In some cases, some of that is very important programmatic things right now, but you know, it does not get away from the point that we are mortgaging our future when it comes to the national economy, national fiscal health, if we don't begin to immediately address the big financial debt problem that we face. We must absolutely tackle fiscal responsibility in the national debt. One of my favorite economists, Thomas Sowell, said it perfectly, which is the first law of economics is we have a scarcity of resources. However, the first law of politics is to ignore the first law of economics. And we have a real problem when we think we can just continue to rack up the bills on the federal credit card. That clearly is not sustainable. We absolutely must tackle fiscal responsibility once we're through this.
That's Jonathan Williams of ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, speaking recently to the John Locke Foundation. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, healthcare, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Well, COVID-19 has had a huge impact on the healthcare industry. We all know that. But it's not just because hospitals and doctors and nurses have been focused on caring for COVID-19 patients. The John Locke Foundation's healthcare policy analyst, Jordan Roberts, has taken a look at what he calls the supply and demand shocks on both hospitals and doctors and other practitioners. And he's also looking at what it could mean for each of us in a post-COVID-19 world. Jordan joins me now to give us a sense of where we're heading. Jordan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So in terms of hospitals, we've heard so much media coverage of, do we have enough hospital beds? Mm-hmm. Do we have enough intensive care beds? Do we have enough ventilators and first responders out there trying to care for people who unfortunately have been stricken with COVID-19? But you took a look at something a little bit different, a little bit more of 30,000-foot approach, so to speak. What did you find?
Right. So, you know, what we have to remember here is that COVID's going to affect different parts of the country in different ways. But when we look at the data nationally, what we see is that there was a decline in revenue and of discharges among hospitals across the whole country. And the studies that I looked at the month of March in this year compared to last year to try to get this data. And what they found was there was consistent decline in revenue and utilization, but it was most profound in the third week of March, right when all the stay-at-home orders and, you know, really when people started to take this thing as seriously, you know, as we are now. And so that's where we see this initial shock of just complete, you know, devastating drop in utilization and revenue for these hospitals.
And Jordan, that seems to me that, at least for me, it's counterintuitive because mm-hmm. I'm thinking, all right, our hospitals are inundated with COVID-19 patients, mm-hmm. but you're saying utilization was actually down?
Correct.
And revenue was down? How's that possible?
Well, like I said, you know, it's going to affect different parts of the country in different ways. But nationally, when we look across on the whole, it was down. So while some more hotspot areas would have, you know, a much different experience in their hospital, they may be filled up. But, you know, hospitals just, you know, 100 miles away may not have that same experience. So, you know, just trying to get a picture of the entire country nationally, utilization and revenue is down for large hospitals.
Hopefully, of course, we will make it through and see a decline in cases and deaths mm-hmm. and some of that we're already seeing. Mm-hmm. But once we get through this, tell us what you believe will be the impact overall on people who are trying to access hospitals and doctors and, mm-hmm. and the system itself.
Yeah. So, you know, what I think about is some of these smaller rural hospitals across the country and in North Carolina where, you know, they were told to cancel elective surgeries and all their, potential patients in the area were told to stay home and not go access care. And, you know, situations like that, they really didn't see an influx of huge patients, of a lot of COVID-19 cases. And, you know, therefore, they had a much different experience than, say, a hospital in New York City. And so, you know, what that does is they were, you know, may not have had to cancel all those elective procedures and lost out on a ton of valuable revenue. And then that puts them, you know, depending on what kind of federal aid they got from the CARES Act or things like that, that puts them in a really, really, you know, precarious spot going forward. And so what we see a lot is healthcare already has a merger and acquisition issue with large hospitals buying up specialty practices, smaller hospitals merging among themselves. And when that happens, patients usually end up paying higher prices and quality can be worse in these hospital systems. And so as more and more hospitals, small hospitals lose revenue because of some of the decisions made trying to react to the COVID pandemic, you know, they may be more susceptible to be bought up by large hospitals and that we could see even further consolidation because of this. And that's a real issue for patients and all of us who pay for these higher healthcare prices.
What a sad irony that is, because essentially we kind of cleared the decks when it came yep. to hospitals, said everybody, unless it's an emergency, stay away. We've got to deal with the pandemic. Mm-hmm. But the reality of that is that a hospital has to make money. Mm-hmm. Doctors and medical professionals have to make money. Are they potentially looking at a bunch of pent-up demand for things that weren't emergencies? I mean, could that help them once people get the okay and go back to the hospital?
I think there's a possibility. But, you know, what I'd say in the paper is, you know, this is looking at March and April, which were, you know, two of the early.
Months.
Right. And so we're going to have to look at the data. And, you know, this is going to be studied for a long time, the effect. But I think it's very likely that, you know, as hospitals open back up, there will be a lot of pent up demand. But, you know, that it might coincide with more COVID cases in the area. So we just don't know how it's going to play out. But, you know, it could be devastating for a lot of these smaller practices.
I have a couple of registered nurses in my extended family in another part of the country. And I was shocked, frankly, to find out that both of them at different points in the last several months were essentially laid off.
Right.
Because as my niece told me, my part of the hospital really isn't functioning anymore. And I don't think people understand that.
No, it's an interesting, really just, you know, counterintuitive paradox that, you know, we clear out all this space, but, you know, in places where there wasn't a huge influx of COVID patients, they were laying off the very healthcare, the frontline healthcare workers that we are, you know, placing so high to protect us from this virus. So, you know, like I said, it plays out different in different parts of the country, but, you know, it's really sometimes just counterintuitive to think about the effect that it's had in certain areas.
Some folks may not realize that their doctor may be actually a small business owner, mm-hmm. may own a practice, and maybe it's one doctor, three doctors, et cetera, and they have a small staff. And so that's a business that they are in. And if they have essentially been put out of business because of COVID-19, then you kind of wonder what the future is. And I guess that, that ties into your argument about consolidation. Everything's
right.
just going to be kind of wrapped up into giant hospital systems.
Right. And that's what we see the same data, you know, in other, these other specialty practices like pediatric care, orthopedic surgeons, oral surgeons, dermatologists, some of these practices that tend to be more independent and have been independent from large hospital change in the past, they in March and April, they saw declines of 70-80% of revenue and 70-80% of utilization. That is just an incredible hit to their business. But also something else I talk about in the piece is with so much less utilization, that can have serious implications for health outcomes in the future. So things like primary care, you know, orthopedics, oral surgeons, things like this, where a patient would go in to get an ailment or something treated that they push off, it might be even more expensive and more be worse for their health in the future. So that's another reason. And like you said, there may be more pent up demand, but it could be that, you know, all these procedures that we put off may end up costing a lot more. So while we have more demand, we're also spending a lot more on healthcare when we may not have had to with all of these closures and with such a steep drop in utilization.
So you looked at data comparing again March and April of this year to March of last year.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
And so there's got to be just such a huge differential
in what
hospitals were dealing with mm-hmm. a year ago. I mean, talk about how the world has changed. That's why this is such a fascinating piece. Actually, two pieces. Mm-hmm. One focused on the impact on hospitals. The other focused on the impact of doctors and other medical professionals. You can find it at johnlock.org. Both pieces are posted there, written by our guest, Jordan Roberts, who is the John Locke Foundation Healthcare Policy Analyst. Jordan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for Carolina Journal Radio this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.